Hi, and welcome to Teaching ATM Better. I'm glad you're here, and I wish you a happy new year for those of you who are celebrating today. Today, I'm doing this today because I'm starting returning to the source the eighth time starting this week. But whether you take the course or not, I'm interested in talking to the rest of us who care about awareness through movement. You know, for me, awareness through movement it's not that I don't love FI, mind you, but I think it really is Moshe's gift. It is really what we have to offer, and it is a way to make what we have to offer accessible to other people. And I don't think it's easy. You know, it's something I've been thinking about before I graduated. You know, when I was an ATM teacher, I was teaching ATM already. And I was thinking about, there's this phrase, preaching to the choir or preaching to the converted. And I, without all the political and historical entanglements, I think of myself a little bit more as a missionary. You know, like I want to figure out how to offer what our work is to people in a way that makes it accessible. I think many years ago, when we had a family reunion, I was sitting with my grandmother on the beach and telling her I was living in San Francisco and doing gay political work. And she looked at me, she tapped me on the knee very gently and said, "That's very nice, darling, but how is that going to help the working class?" And, that question, she's my grandmother, I love her. And that question always lingers. And so when I started teaching ATM, I got interested in what I will now call industrial strength Feldenkrais. Like, how can we teach Feldenkrais awareness through movement on the job? Because I thought this would be perfect. The employer would pay for it, and the employee would benefit. I mean, this was in the early 1980s, right? So, or the mid 1980s. And the word ergonomics was hardly known. I mean, it really came a few years later. So, it's kind of like with fashion. It's awful to be ahead of your time, right? Or maybe that far behind. I don't know. But I thought, okay, well, how can I do this? And at that time, one of my housemates was a bus driver. And when I was finishing the training, I was still at university finishing my bachelor's degree. And I had a job in the morning. I was a cook. And I would get up at the crack of dark and take the bus up to the university and make soups and sandwiches and bake and then open the cafe. And I would watch the bus driver. It was like the first bus in the morning, 5:30. And sometimes, there's this phrase that, rolls around in my head, an accident waiting to happen. And it just so happened that one of my housemates at the time was a bus driver. So our evening conversations turned to the subject, right? Because I was in the training, I was talking about it. And he said, "Well, you should do something for us." I was like, "Oh, okay." So I put together a program. Wrote a letter to the head of the transit district, introduced myself, didn't hear anything back. So I wrote another letter just to remind them to make sure they got the first one, just in case they got lost in the mail. Remember that? The mail. And then I called a few times and, no one called me back. Now, I live in a small town, relatively small town. Much bigger than the one I grew up in, but Santa Cruz is that time was about 50,000 people. But it just so happened that I was pretty good friends with the mayor. So one night we were having dinner, and I said to him, "Bruce, I'm trying to do this, and no one's talking to me. You know who I should talk to?" And he said, "Let me take care of it." Next day, I got a phone call from the secretary of the assistant director of the transit district asking me if I wanted to set up a meeting. So I did. And boy, did I get dressed up. I mean, really, I got my suit out. I had a tie. I am not kidding. I had an attaché case. It was filled with all the information about the Feldenkrais method that was available at the time. So it was like three articles copied 14 times, right? And I had written out the whole curriculum for the program and the rationale. I walked into the office and I shook this woman's hand. She asked me to sit down, and she said, "I've looked at your materials." I said, "Well, thank you." And I started to open my briefcase, and she said, "We're really interested in what you have to offer." That was one of the few moments in my life where I was at a loss for words. I had no idea what to say because I was ready to argue. So, I had my idea here was to take the movements that the bus drivers did, turning the wheel, and their wheel is not like a car wheel; it's horizontal. And sitting in those god-awful seats, because back then they were all really kind of like hollowed out seats, and the way the seat belt held you in, it was really, if you wore it snugly, it was difficult to rotate your pelvis forward and back, side, twist. So looking at getting in and out of the chair, looking at turning your head to look at the mirrors, and the buses here, they don't have a back window. Right, so you have three mirrors, one on the driver's side to see traffic there, one outside the door, and there is the safety mirror in the middle to see what's going on in the bus. So the bus driver had to turn her or his head to do that. So, the idea was to take the actions from their what they were doing and to teach this as a course about efficient movement and safety. It was a really fun class. When we did the turning the wheel part, we went out onto the bus. And each of the bus drivers took a turn sitting at the wheel, turning beforehand. And we had done a few other lessons already. So we could talk about how they were turning their head and what they saw. And, people are amazingly observant in these situations. Like one bus driver was. So everybody had to take the training. At least a third of the people had driven for other bus companies. And at some point, somebody was up there, and someone at the back of the bus said, "No wonder your head hurts. You get headaches. Look at what you're doing with your shoulders." I mean, I didn't say that, right? But it was kind of it was friendly, but it created a conversation, created a situation where people were interested. And the class got great reviews. And they asked me back, and I proposed. I had done a 4.5 hour program, I think, like three times. And I proposed doing, I think it was six times. And they said yes. And then I said, "Well, it was great." One day I was walking down the street, a bus pulls over in the middle of the block, the door opens, and the bus driver said, "My back was killing me before your class. Thank you." And just pulled away, right? And that's what people said in their reviews. So I talked to the assistant director again and said, "Well, this is working. Let's take some statistics, at least ask people, what they can do before and after and what their experience is." And she looked at me, she said, "We're not going to do that." And I was a little puzzled. The advantage of living in a small town is people are a little more frank than they might otherwise be. And she looked at me, she said, "Look, I understand why you want to do that, but we can't do that. Because if we did that would mean that we would have to admit that there was a problem." Right? And at that time, I was working as a Feldenkrais teacher in one of the local physical therapy clinics. And in a stretch of 2 months, we had seen six people from the same business. So, I called up the manager there and said, "Hey, we've seen a bunch of your people here, and I was wondering if you might be interested in an injury prevention class, And his response said, "I don't know what you're talking about. We don't have a problem." As my Feldenkrais mom always says, I suffer from a severe case of enthusiasm. And what I didn't realize in my optimism is how difficult it is to do prevention, right? People want to fix things after they break and not before. Anyways, that was a long time ago. And since then, I have played with and experimented with different ways of teaching ATM and reaching people. And I think that's part of what it means to teach ATM better. I would like to suggest that we would do better by making what we do less special. More everyday, more ordinary. I think I remember teaching in New Zealand a couple summers ago and talking to the husband of one of the participants and about the method, and he said, "You're the first person I talked to about this that didn't put a hurdle between us, that didn't make me have to understand you before I could talk to you about this." And that struck me. I mean, I appreciated the compliment, but I thought the insight was really worthwhile. And I think that's what has inspired me to think about, like, how do we make what we do something, I mean, yeah, ordinary, something that fits into people's lives. And I think the biggest problem with that is people don't have a category for what we do, right? So, I mean, category theory is a big thing in linguistics. But the practical aspect of this is, you say what you do, and people say, "Is it like?" Sometimes they say, "Well, yeah, it's like yoga because we're in odd positions, and it's like Tai Chi because it's slow." But that's like saying, "Have you had Tibetan food?" It's like Chinese food, and it's like Indian food, but it's not either one. I don't know how much that helps. So, the question is, what are we offering people? If it's not exercise, and if it's not rehabilitation, and if it's not therapy or spiritual growth, not that it doesn't do all of those things, but what is it that we offer? And, from this conversation 2 summers ago, which really, it was one of those, there's those moments where somebody says something and you just, it's been turning, my head's been turning around it, I guess. I think what this person said to me is, if there's one word, if there's one word that you can use to say what you do, what is that? And, my instantaneous response was coordinate. Now, I like verbs over nouns. One of my favorite bumper stickers says, "Help stamp out nouns," but I'll take coordination even, right? What we do is we, and I'll tell you what most Feldenkrais teachers say when I say that. They say, "Well, what about balance?" And I say, "Well, they go together, but I had to choose one word," right? Part of balancing is coordinating your movement with your sensation, right? The fundamental notion, I think, for me about our work is the sensory motor loop, right? The relationship between action and perception. And, between us, action, perception, and intention. But the sensory motor loop will do for now. So the fundamental aspect of what we're doing is not just coordinating our action, but we're coordinating our action with our perception. That's the nature of the nervous system and the heart of our work. So I have a title for a book, and I was preparing this, I said, I'm going to say anything but this, but I'm going to tell you because God knows, I mean, I have time between 4:30 and 5:30 in the morning free to write, but maybe I won't get to it. So, you know, what I say to people these days is that most people think about getting better physically, they want to get stronger. The thing is, strength is only half of the equation. Now, I know you're being polite, but you want to ask, or you don't need to ask, because I just told you, but people ask, or they fight that, like, oh, I know you want me to ask. What's the other half? The other half is coordination. And I think by saying that, we declare our terrain. We make clear that what we have to offer isn't what anybody else does. That our expertise is in the neurophysical aspect of how we are in the world. You know, and that's part of our development. Our life is a journey through the changing episodes of our body. And physical education is important from the beginning to the end, or neurophysical education, which is what I think we do. So for me, this gives me an opening for talking to people. So that was one of the things I wanted to talk to you about. And I know if I talk about something else, this will get buried. So let me stop there. And I'm really interested in your comments or questions or responses. I also asked about what questions you've been asking about the work and where you are with it. So I'm curious about how I said resonates with where you are. I want to talk about the teaching of the method next, but let's save that maybe for part two.
I want to know, so what happened? You didn't do the six times with the bus?
I did.
And it was like once a week, like for a half an hour, or what was the cadence of it?
It was an hour and 15 minutes, I think, each class. And it was once a week for 6 weeks. Something like that, or an hour and a half, because, you know, so one of the classes I did before that page was for the 911 operators. And those of you who aren't from the States, that's the emergency number that you call if you get the police or firemen or whatever, fire people. And it was a horrible workshop. It was one of the most fucking miserable failures I've ever had in my life. And that's saying a lot. Not quite as bad as when I was a magician and the doves flew up and they were on the rafters the whole show and everybody else made a joke out of it. But anyway, I could not get people's attention. It was a required course. We were sitting in a conference room. One person stared out the window the whole time. It's this long ago. One person smoked the entire time. Right? And they weren't having fun. I wasn't having fun. One of my best friends came over afterwards who I was helping him facilitate courses. And he said, how was your workshop? And I said, hey, dinner's almost ready. And he's like, well, how was your workshop? And I said, beautiful weather. And he's like, how was your workshop? I said, I think they weren't ready for it. And he said, what do you mean? How are the evaluations? I said, So we sat out on the stoop and I read them and they were terrible. Like, I don't know why I'm here. This doesn't make sense. What are we doing? Blah, blah, blah. I mean, a couple of people liked it, but one of the things he asked me is, how are you making this relevant to them? Right? And that's where the idea, like with the bus drivers of situating the lessons inside an action, right? Not, you know, and then doing the lessons so you have this time to explore something separate and then coming back to it. That answers the so what question implicitly. And, you know, basically, I'm a pragmatist. You know, I'm interested in how something works and what it's good for and what it does. And that, I think that fits my approach to learning. If the ATM book was called Developing Abilities in Hebrew, then I think that's what we're doing. And abilities develop from the specific to the general. So I made that time so there was ways for people to interact. So one of the lessons I taught was turning the head from the senior citizen series, the elder citizen series, where you're sitting and turning and differentiating. But at the beginning, I had people pair up. And I made a few simple distinctions about, you know, what was moving when they turn their head. Did their shoulders move, one or both of them, in the same direction? Did their chest move? And then, you know, people could look at each other and talk about that, and then they could see the difference at the end. And it wasn't me telling them, but it was their partners, because I wanted to leave them with something with each other, that the lesson wasn't just a private experience, but it was part of their social milieu. How's that little academic stuff thrown in there? But, you know, part of their way of being together. The next lesson after that, one of the guys said, "Oh, I went home, I looked at my wife, and you should see the way she turns her head. It was totally crazy. Her shoulders went one way, her head went the other. It was so funny." And I looked at him, I said, I said, "I think what's really funny about that is that that's what you did before the lesson." You know, I mean, that this isn't about being superior. It's about noticing what we're doing ourselves. So to create a situation where it's social as well as personal, right? I don't think that has to be forced. You know, when I do those exercises, I always tell people they don't have to do it, right? But learning movement is a social activity. If you put babies, if you isolate them from human beings, which has tragically happened at various times in our history intentionally, or you purposefully stunt their development, right? In the deaf community in the 1950s in the United States, the decision was that everybody needed to learn to lip read. So the deaf schools prevented the students and inhibited them, forbade them from using sign language. And this created an incredible cognitive stunting of those people, because you have to learn language. I mean, the evidence is there's a wide window, but somewhere between 3 and 7 years old. And if you don't learn it by then your brain doesn't develop. And you can't express certain things. It just doesn't seem possible. And so there was this whole generation of people, right, with the best intentions, who were, you know, whose development was interfered with. And I will take speech as an example of movement, yes. We have to interact. We learn to move together. And I think in our classes, one of the reasons that, you know, classes don't, they're hard to get people to come to is because people come to class to learn from each other and from and with the teacher, you know? And if that doesn't happen, I think, well, you know, it's an amazing class for people who are self-learners, and that's a small slice of the population, and they're going to go home without talking to you or each other. But I think we need to reach everybody else too. Sorry, that was a long answer, Paige.
My husband is a rail operator, but before that, he was a bus driver. So I'm very curious about, because it's such repetitive movement, always going to the left or always looking at the right to, you know, I know they have big benefits for massage and things like that. And I was always thinking, when he's a rail operator now, but when he was a bus driver, I was always thinking, oh, do they have space? Like, where? I was asking him, where do you have a cafeteria? Where, like, where did you do it? You know?
Well, I'm working on this new series of ATMs that kind of solves that problem. Because one of the things I give, you know, like, we don't have equipment, right? Which I think is too bad, because like I swear, sometimes I'm in a city and I'm looking at people on the metro or the subway. In fact, I think I've said this to Boris once in Spain. Like, I think half these people are just carrying their yoga mats to look cool, right? I mean, we don't have any of that stuff, but which is good and bad, I guess, whatever. But I think to give people homework, you know, what can I give them that's interesting? And so, like, one of my best friends is the doorway, right? It's now, I would love to teach a workshop of doorway lessons, but I haven't found a room with enough doors in it. So, but I figured that would be perfect for an online class, was because you can do all these things using the doorway as a constraint and moving within it and around it. So it's been really fun to play with that idea. There's a Feldenkrais teacher and a physical therapist from Sweden who works for the railroad company. And it's been fun. I've had a community, we've been in contact for couple of decades now, but it's been really cool to talk to her about, you know, working with the different people and what their jobs are and thinking about ATM. So
is a Feldenkrais practitioner? What's her name?
You know, I have CRS, so can't remember shit, but I can look it up for you. I can send it to you, Paige. Send me an email if you will and remind me, okay?
Is it Ava Lazar?
No. Okay.
I wouldn't think she worked in rail.
No, Ava, no, but she certainly is a steam engine.
Yes.
Larry, this is Krish in DC. I just finished teaching a class now, which was extremely full, and there were like four new people, and two of them couldn't even get to the floor, but I have open enrollment in my classes. And normally this Sunday group is a group which is kind of, we develop in a community of brains. You know, everybody hangs out and we really have a good time together. But the whole nature of the class changed because I was really trying to make these three people, two of whom could not get to the floor. Somehow they registered and I didn't realize it. And it really disrupted everything, the flow of my own train of thinking. And I completely changed what I was going to do. I was totally not going to teach that lesson. But, you know, somehow it worked. And I think it was partly because everybody in the class was already a community and they were sort of like, okay, yeah, we get it. We're going to, you know, help support these people. And I think what you just said kind of illuminated that we do learn from each other. We learn from the teacher, but really the teacher shouldn't teach. It should just, you know, as they say, create those conditions and get out of the way. And I could have gotten even more out of the way, actually, had I been smart. But anyway, it worked out, and it worked out mostly for everybody. It worked out pretty well. But there were definitely those moments where I thought, gosh, is it important perhaps just to really not let beginners come to an ongoing class? Or I don't know what your thoughts are about that, but it happens being in DC, it's such a, you know, peripatetic population that if I didn't do that, I'd have, you know, very different clients. Number of clients.
Thanks for your question. You know, when people are beginning to teach ATM, one of the things we talk about is, you know, what makes it difficult to teach a group. And I think there's a couple of things. One is to teach awareness and movement. I mean, just in general, because then you have people there for all different kinds of reasons. So it's really hard to, you know, have a curriculum when everybody wants a different class. So I think it's good to have a theme, you know, whatever that is, because it also means you're addressing people specifically rather than saying the work is good for, in general, for everyone. And I think it's easier for people to say yes when they have some idea of what the context is. So that's one thing. And I think the other thing that's really difficult is to have an open enrollment class. For two reasons. One is the Feldenkrais side of it, right? Which is that you have to, well, as they say in business these days, onboard. You have to onboard the people. You know, you have to introduce them to the culture of the class and how we learn. And the difficulty there is that you put your attention on the new people and you ignore your loyal students. And so they're, in a way, they're not rewarded for returning. And so it creates a dynamic, and that's the second part of it, you know, the group dynamic part of it, which is that the first thing a group has to figure out is safety. And if people are coming in all the time, it's really hard to get that sense. So I think it's doubly difficult. And I think you're probably a good enough teacher to be able to deal with that. One time I was working with a colleague in the Midwest here in the US, and she was working for this big medical center, and they had a contract with trucking companies. And so she wanted to design a 10 ATM class series for truck drivers. And she had known I'd worked with the bus drivers, so we worked stuff out together. And then a couple weeks before it was supposed to start, right when they were going to announce it, so maybe 6 weeks or something, the management of the center, of the medical center, changed. And the director called her in and said, well, look, we like your idea of the class, but we're going to make it open enrollment so anybody can come, right? And if they can come at any time, right? So you can't have a class where they have to start, because they're truck drivers, so they have to be able to come whenever they want. And we talked about the problem, like, so how do we deal with this? Because, you know, she didn't have any control. People could come and go. I mean, pedagogically speaking, it's really hard to do a series, right? But even so, even if you're just going to do one lesson each individually, how do you get people acclimated? So what we came up with was 9 different ways to do it, right? So for instance, one time would be talking about the Weber-Fechner law and the idea of doing less and why it's more important. Another time was talking about lag, right? That, you know, when we move, our experience of it is that it's instantaneous, right? We think about a movement and, I mean, we're already doing it or we're almost done, but actually it takes time. I mean, from the moment you decide to move and there's a change in your central nervous system, to the moment that the signal gets to your muscles, I mean, that's quarter of a second. And then your muscles contract another quarter of a second. And then the signals go back to your spinal cord and back to your brain. Another quarter, I mean, 3/4 of a second. And you can move faster than you can notice. And if you want to change how you move, we have to notice what you're doing. So, you know, that's another way of approaching it. But so each class had one metaphor. And I thought the best idea we came up with, actually, was after doing that 2 or 3 times, the next time somebody new came in, asking the people in the class what they had to learn at the beginning of doing ATM so they could benefit from it. So that way they were rewarded for being loyal students and recognized. And they were also participating in the teaching and learning. So maybe that'll help, Chris.
Yeah, that was really helpful. That's kind of what I resorted to in the end, and probably there'll be more discussion next week. But yeah, no, thank you so much. It was great.
Well, you know, another thing that's really cool is to ask people at the beginning of the class what they got from the last class or what they did with it. You know, I mean, my favorite example once was one of my neighbors in Champaign, said, that was the perfect gardening lesson. I was out in the garden on my knee pads and I was doing the movements. And then she said, but later I was feeling kind of cranky and my body wasn't feeling great. So I got in the bathtub and I thought, this is a great bathtub lesson. But what was really cool about it was, you know, it's like when somebody in class talks about a lesson in their dreams, and then the next class, everyone talks about their dreams. Well, people started talking about what they were doing with it, and people started, you know, some people, you could just see they were going, oh, you could do this outside of class? Right? And I, of course, I'd said it, but when the students say it, it means something different. I think mixing up how that happens, and especially leaving it out sometimes, right? So it's not the same thing all the time. That's what makes for a lively and interesting class. I mean, it's like not doing the same scan every day, because I think that just puts people to sleep.
Thank you.
Thanks. Anyone else? Oh, I never finished responding to Jillian. There we go. She asked me how much money I made from doing those classes back then. And I don't remember. It was more than 30 years ago. I'm not sure how relevant it would be. But, you know, I think people, I think it depends on the way you present yourself. You know, if you go into a corporate situation and you present it like you're teaching yoga, you'll get paid like you're a yoga teacher. If you present it like you're... The phrase I use these days is that, you know, it's coordination coaching. You know, that what we specialize in is how people coordinate and how themselves and how to improve that. And, you know, I would say you can be really strong and really uncoordinated. Right? I mean, it's, we need both of them. Okay, let me switch gears. Hey, Paula, I saw you had to leave in a few minutes, so I'm going to say goodbye before you leave. Thanks for joining us. So about teaching awareness and movement better. You know, this morning I had the pleasure of Barbara Kronbacher, I think her name is. I think I messed up her last name, but we did AY38 in the... AYA day group this morning, heading back distinctions, or twisting it around yourself in every which way. And I think that is just such a wonderful thing. I am so grateful to, you know, be able twice a day, if I want to, lie down on the floor and do an ATM lesson with my colleagues. When I was in graduate school, I live 3.5 hours away from another Father Christ teacher. You know, I can get a lesson or do an ATM class. I had moved from San Francisco, where I live, you know, well, half an hour at the most from a Father Christ teacher I could get a lesson from. So, you know, having community and learning from each other is, I just think it's a great thing. One of the things I did the lesson last night too, like, kind of like ATM. I don't know about you, but after class we were talking and somebody asked me what was the latest thing I was thinking about and what had I been learning. And it was one of those moments where, you know, I had too many thoughts and only one mouth, but I talked about one thing, and I want to talk about that and something else today. The thing that always strikes me in that group and in our conversations is, you know, the perspective from which we understand a lesson, or from which we our stance in relationship to the lesson or our experience of it. Because, like in this morning, this morning's lesson, I was like the perfect preparation for getting ready for this talk, and it was one of these delightful lessons. It was a bunch of movements that I knew from other lessons, and it was also one of these lessons that had this kind of delightful, very fast, light movement. And when I can manage to find that, right, I don't know, it's like being a kid on a swing or something like that, or sitting on the porch when the wind is blowing lightly or something. It was really great. You know, and I think the purpose of the lessons is to create these kinds of experience for our students. Yeah, I always say to students at the end of the training that it doesn't matter to me whether they practice at their home or in an office or in a hospital or in a dance studio or a stable or on the sand at the beach. It doesn't really matter where they practice. It doesn't matter if they practice. I would much rather them be, if they teach, I would much rather them be someone who practices the method and doesn't teach it than someone who teaches it and doesn't practice it. You know, so I think as a Feldenkrais teacher, my aim is to help my students to inspire them to practice the method. And I think that, you know, we have to be connected to our experience of the method because it's an experiential method. And I don't think we can understand the method only from that perspective, right? I don't think Moshe did. I mean, Moshe was human. And, you know, sometimes I think he didn't do scans because he didn't need to do a scan. He was just so incredibly aware of himself. I don't know, maybe not. But, you know, I marvel still doing the lessons and listening to him and watching him. But I think, you know, he had blind spots like all of us. And I think one of the most incredible things for me about the lessons is that there are no... He mixes up left and right. He says some things that historically about the nervous system or whatever we know are different now, but no lesson's wrong. No lesson's based on an incorrect premise. Not one that I've found. No lesson, I mean, they may be challenging, they may be confusing, but, you know, somehow he could get beyond the limitation of his perspective. And I think that meant that he had to look at and experience and understand the lesson, not just from the student's perspective, but from the teacher's perspective. And that's where I think, you know, and that's where I think we struggle. I think Moshe's strategy as a trainer, and many of our strategies as trainers, is that when somebody, a trainee, asks a question, we answer the question as if they are a student, right? Not as if they're a future teacher. And I think future teachers at some point need a framework for understanding from the teacher's perspective how you create an environment for learning, a place where somebody can learn. And one that's rich enough where they can learn what they have to learn, not what you learn. Because that's the other thing. We all learn something from a lesson, and we can be so enthralled, relieved, thankful for that, that we think that's what the lesson has to teach everybody. And I think lessons are richer than that. So I think it's important to be able to understand the lesson, not just from our perspective as the student, but from the teacher's perspective. And I would say really from the perspective of our methodology. So this morning, after this lesson, we were talking about we're talking about the lesson. And so in this lesson, you are, well, I'll give you a short synopsis for those of you who weren't there. It starts where you're hugging yourself and you're rolling. You're lying on your back, your knees are bent. And at the beginning, you're rolling your shoulders, and then you roll your head with your shoulders, and then your pelvis, and then you begin to, you know, keep your pelvis still or keep your head still. And the lesson progresses. You're doing this lying on your back and on your belly, and you're rolling, holding your head still or holding your pelvis still. And then at one point, you're on your back and you lift your pelvis in the air, and you're turning your pelvis. Another point, you're translating your pelvis with your pelvis in the air. You're rolling your pelvis with your legs flopping, and you're rolling your pelvis with one knee going forward and back. You're on your back and you're rolling your pelvis and holding your head still. And at one point you bend your knees and you keep your legs together and you tilt them. And then at the extreme of the tilt, you take the leg that's going towards the floor and you lift it away. Both legs are going towards the floor, and you lift the knee of the top leg away. So every one of these variations, right? If I look at it from the student's perspective, I mean, from the inside, each variation illuminates my experience. I notice things I didn't notice. There are moments where, where I was like lying on the back with my head lifted, rolling my head, and my back was like, you know, sugar pop, snack, crackle, pop. It was really amazing. My lower, it wasn't doing, you know, it was like incredible. That's my experience internally. As a teacher, I ask a question, well, you know, how is it structured so that that happens? And Abby Lyons from Ireland, who graduated from my first Amsterdam training, she was asking about the, when the pelvis was lifted and what that was about and, you know, what we thought about it. And when I said, you know, like, because she said she could do that and feel her pelvis rolling, because Moshe talked about turning the pelvis around the spine. She asked about what that meant. And she said, you know, sometimes she did that and her pelvis rolled and her chest rolled, and sometimes she did that and her head rolled with it. And I said, well, when you lift your pelvis, there you go. So, you know, you're lying on your back and you lift your pelvis and your spine, then the place where, this is your spine and my hand is, top hand's the pelvis, then what happens is you're twisting around the place that's on the floor, right? I mean, you could twist your chest with your pelvis, but then your legs are going to be moving. If your legs are still and your pelvis is twisting, it's not going side to side, and the movement is small enough, what you've done is you've changed the fulcrum. And so the axis of rotation is going to be above that. And holding your pelvis up in the air means there's enough extra tone in your lower back and lower abdominal region that you're not going to twist so much there, right? You're twisting your pelvis. The vertebra of your hips, the lower lumbar vertebra, are below the top of your pelvis. So you will be twisting somewhere in your mid-lumbar spine. I mean, there's only a few vertebrae there. Or above that, in your thoracic spine, up to the place where you're lying on the floor. Right? So seeing how that position opens some doors and closes others, right? I think being able to understand the lesson, not so much muscularly, but as the people in the antipodes would say, skeletally, right? From the point of view of your skeleton, allows you to see the biomechanics of the movement. And Moshe's artful use of these changing positions as a way of really, you know, closing off the doors that we would usually open, so that we have to find other doors to open in the movement, in the lesson. And I think if I don't understand the lesson from that perspective, then if I don't know that's what we're looking for, then I don't know what to say to a student. So, you know, what I said to Abby after explaining it was, you know, she said, you know, if your head is moving, then that means you're moving your chest as well. Right. And so, you know, I've known her for a long time. So I said, you know, I know I've said this to you before, excuse me for saying it again, but maybe if you do a little smaller movement, so you can find out how your pelvis can do that rotation and your chest can be still. So there you go. That's what I mean by the teacher's perspective. And what I think that means is, I think that means having conceptual models for how to reliably, easily unpack the lesson in a way that if we ask questions of a lesson, that we would come up with the same answers because we would use the same methodology. I think what would make us different as teachers is how we teach the lesson. Right? It's like being a cook, you know. I mean, you have to understand the cooking, the chemistry of cooking if you want to change it. If you want to change anything. And you can, you know, you can substitute pasta for rice, but the dish stays the same. All right, I just saw Carol wrote this long thing here. I'm going to take a moment to read it. Oh, thank you. Okay, thanks. So you said something about giving them permission. I think about at the beginning of a class, Carol, you know, how do you want to start the journey, right? And so for me, what I want to do is have some way of engaging, tantalizing the person, finding a way to help them be curious. Right. And so one way to do that is starting with the movement in the context of an everyday movement or a certain idea or a question that somebody in the class has. And then I think about the theme of the lesson, and then I think about the topics that relate to it. So the stories I would use or the concepts or examples. I mean, if I'm using them in a lesson, and, you know, it's like I stick to one metaphor rather than have three or four, and I approach it in different ways. And, you know, I love mythology and fairy tales and stuff like that. So sometimes I tell that kind of story. Sometimes with some classes I've done, you know, like, lessons are like books. So I will teach lessons in a different style. So one time it's a travelogue, and one time it's a recipe. And so it's like different ways of people thinking about and engaging in the lesson separate from the content of the lesson. And that gives people a structure to engage into. Heidi, I was talking about AY38, the head and back. Called distinctions and turning. Someone pointed out during the class that there was another lesson that was exactly like it, but I don't remember it. Anyways, I'll write it down. Did that help, Carol? Yeah, your mic's not working, sorry. But you can type, I can read. It's good to see you anyway, it's been a long time. So, my aim is to, nothing that I'm saying is absolute or even right. it's best I can do. It's what I've been thinking about for a while. And I just think the world is ready for what we have to offer. You know, I mean, people talk about neuroplasticity, like, I don't know, you know, it's like, it's easy to understand. You know, but it's a concept. You know, people talk, I run training programs in the Netherlands, and I mean, mindfulness had just, you know, a few years ago, like mindfulness had everything, you know, mindfulness in schools and mindfulness in consulting. And it was like everywhere. You could buy, I swear, you can buy mindfulness pants in Holland, you know? And it was just like, I said we had a quarterly, well, no, bi-monthly is meta meeting for people who run training programs, the International Somatic Movement Education and Therapy Association. And I said in our conversation that I'm sick of and fed with all this mindfulness. Why don't we have a little bodyfulness? And it turns out someone wrote a book about that. It just got published, called Bodyfulness. I haven't checked it out yet, but what a great idea. Nancy Laurel, thank you. Nancy Laurel says the other lesson is AY230 self-hug with the arms. Anyway. Hello, Heidi. Aloha.
Aloha. Can you hear me?
Now.
Let's see if this will help.
Good.
You know, in the music work with Tocatino, which works, it's kind of like Feldenkrais with rhythm. He talks a lot about curiosity also. And in Kauai, there's a lot of youth that come here to work with the earth because they're afraid of change and global warming. And they go, how do we find hope? How do we find a way through this? And so I my mind is on it a lot because I'm around these youth. And I can't help but think when you're talking about curiosity and what you're talking about today, the inclusiveness, because
you're dropping out there. We didn't hear the last 30 seconds or so. Maybe you could write it down. I want to hear what you have to say. Oops. She disappeared. She'll be back. You know, I think, look, curiosity is one aspect of being ready for learning, right? And look, along the lines with that, I want to say one other thing about that. You know, because Carol, what you said, I kind of slid by some of it. And I want to go back to it. I think the emotional part of, you know, how we set the stage in the class, how we invite people to participate, is really important. I mean, learning is an emotional experience. Curiosity is an emotion. Boredom is an emotion. Frustration, joy, elation, discovery. Well, all these things. If we're in the years back when I was teaching workshops for physical therapists, one of the questions that they would ask about the method is, do you deal with emotions? And I would say, I work with human beings, of course, right? Because, I mean, that's where we are. And when I was working in physical therapy, people were scared, or they were angry about what happened to them, or frustrated. I mean, same thing with our students now, right? It was like, these are emotions. So I think in that regard, you know, our emphasis on making classes safe, right? That's really important. That's part of what I was talking to Chris about earlier. But I think we are also human, and so we will fail, right? We will fail and along the way. And I think those are great moments, because it's in the moment where whatever we've done didn't work for the person. Maybe we didn't do anything wrong, it just didn't work for them. But it's how we respond to someone when it doesn't work. that gives us a chance to really show people that it's safe, right? And so those moments are really disturbing to us as a teacher, because I don't know about you, but I feel like, you know, I failed at making somebody feel safe, and I can feel defensive or frustrated or whatever. But, you know, if I take a moment, I'm really appreciative that here is a chance to show somebody how I can respond to them feeling not safe and make it safer, or just, if nothing else, at least acknowledge it, right? And I think that's the beginning of creating safety. And I think the other enemies to learning besides fear are guilt, blame, and particularly shame, right? And I think that's the other reason. I was a pretty snarky teenager, and there was one point in my life where I thought that, don't laugh at me, Beth Rubenstein. There's a time in my life where I thought that insults were the highest form of humor. And, you know, and I came from a rather rambunctious cultural setting. So, you know, I think the thing I've learned the most over time is just to be kinder, right? Because we all have the moments where we feel stupid or not good enough or clumsy or whatever it is. I mean, people, when we say self-image, you know, we talk about it from the sensory side, but there's a psycho-emotional aspect of that. And, you know, people bring that with them. And I think that's one of the hurdles that they bring with them that we have to help them get past. So I also think that's part of the responsibility of the teachers to offer a framework for learnings, because that creates a container. It says, here, we're doing this together and we're doing it in this way. So, you know, I don't think we have to be therapists. I have no interest in that, but I think a good teacher, it doesn't matter if it's your piano teacher or you're learning how to fix cars or, you know, the Zen of motorcycle maintenance, it is, you know, you're going to learn about being human in that context and about learning. And, you know, we are part of that tradition. We what we have to offer is special, but, you know, it's the second oldest tradition known to humanity, education. Okay. Just reading the comments here. So Carol, you just wrote, can I read what you wrote? Is that okay? Yeah. So Carol wrote, oh God, yes. I not very long ago touched someone during a class, as I often do, who really didn't want to be touched. She was very uncomfortable, and I never had this happen before. We talked about it a little after class, and it was a question of her feeling safe from the inside. It was incredibly uncomfortable for me and a big shock. Now I always remember to ask new people if they are okay with being touched during class, or if they would prefer not. Granted, some Feldies never touch people, but I often do. This has to do with safety. I am so glad you said that. So, like, you know, there are some people who said, I've actually had people say this to me, well, in FI, we touch and we don't talk. And in ATM, we talk and we don't touch. Obviously, they've never watched Moshe give an FI. But and that's an artificial thing. And I think FTI and FM and FTM, I mean, I think mixing it up, I think giving individual ATMs, I think all that is really wonderful. I think I would say, I would generalize what you said. So one of the exercises that we do in the training is, I think of this as an exercise because it's a skill that I think you need to practice. So, you know, there's a moment where you go from working with the class to working with an individual, right? That moment is from the group process point of view is fraught with so many delicacies, or the intricacies, I should say, right? I mean, first of all, you don't want to leave the rest of the class behind. So I think you either have to mark the transition. You have to say something to the class, you know, like, I'm going to go help so-and-so. Would you please continue this? Let me know if you have a question. And before you do that, or before I do that, you know, there's a couple of steps, and I really have people practice this, so they kind of get the hang of it, because I think permission is the basis of safety, right? So what I do is I either go over to the person or you know, look at them and say, I wonder if you know, I noticed something that I might be able to help you with. Are you interested? Before I touch them, right? So I look at them, and if they say no, I say, okay, thank you. Right? And I really like it when people say no, so the whole class gets the idea that you don't have to say yes, right? And if they say yes, then the first thing I do is I go over, and whether I'm touching them or not, the first thing is really about awareness. So I want to underline or highlight or reflect something about what they're doing. So do you notice that when your pelvis is rolling, your legs are swaying side to side? Right? And then can you feel which one moves more easily or which one moves out more easily? You know, so I take some time to be with them. And then I say, well, what would happen if you don't do that? Right? Like, or, you know, and I might, sometimes I hold the, I put my hand there, I ask them to do it. Sometimes I've taken a chair and just put a chair next to the outside of somebody's knee so they have a measure outside. And I say, now try it. Do you feel the difference? And then I take the chair or my hand away and I say, do it again. And so, because I want to leave them with a distinction. Right, with a contrast, not a correction. So, you know, the three steps are ask for permission, go along with what they're doing, accompany them, introduce a distinction and make sure they can tell the difference, and leave them with that. Because, you know, I guess, you know, being that I was a teenager when I started Following Christ Method, I was always offended when somebody said, I'm giving you choices. So my granddad used to say, you know, who died and left you God? Like, really? You're giving me choices? You know, I think it is arrogant. Who are we to give people choices? What we do is we help people tell differences. When they have a difference, then they can make a choice. And I think this process kind of follows along with that spirit.
Sorry, can I just say something about that for one
Please.
Second? So I agree entirely with you on, you know, the asking of permission and then making it into perhaps a learning teaching moment. But there are times when, like Carol, I often, like today, for example, I would never have gone through the class, or the people would not been able to do the lesson if I hadn't just put my hand in a place where it was clear they weren't aware. And I just took a second to do it. And I didn't want to draw attention to them as being, oh my God, I have to, you know what I mean? I mean, I know you know what I mean, but I do think there's something to kind of come up to a person, particularly if they see you coming or they're already a student and they know that they're safe, but just to give them a slight clue, a slight touch in just that place, hopefully the right place. But I think there is value to that, because here's the other funny thing I've noticed is that in a class, when I've done that frequently, I mean very frequently, at people at the end say, oh, do you have any openings ready for FI? And I'm not doing it for that reason, but it's just because they felt that connection.
Well, so, you know, Krish, if I was in your class, I would be comfortable if you did that, because we've known each other and we have a relationship, right? I think it's presuming that.
Yeah, I know.
And like, I remember being at the DC conference, and there was, you know, we had that was a one where it was a big workshop where everyone was participating in a one day workshop. And I was in the back of the room one morning, I think it was Jeff's workshop. And I was just kind of sitting back and observing, and across the room as people were getting together, I could I knew who my trainees were because before they started to work with someone, they said, may I touch you? I think knocking before entering is a sign of respect, right? And so, and I think we have to be able to tell when, you know, I think that I would rather ask than not ask, but there are certainly situations where you have a relationship where I think the formality is unnecessary, right? And I think what you said is really important, that as you walk over, you're making contact with the person, right? So you're not just like plopping down and doing something. So yeah, hopefully. Yeah, I wasn't excluding that. But I, you know, I think this had to do with maybe part of my frame of reference being thinking about dropping classes and new people. Yeah. So absolutely. Thanks for saying that. Yeah, I think, Carol, I think people do. And, you know, one thing I said in passing is, well, recently in a training, I had a trainee write last year the training and say, well, I'm so excited about teaching FI. How much do you think I should be charging? And, you know, I wrote her back and said, you shouldn't be teaching FI because you haven't graduated yet. And, you know, I have to tell you that because that's what your contract says. You know, it'd be kind of weird if somebody hadn't finished medical school and they were doing surgery, right? Just not the way we do things. I said, however, I think, you know, I understand that you want to do more than teaching ATM class. And she's been teaching ATM. She's a sportive. She's really athletic. And so she's been teaching with different people that she does sports with. And really like in all kinds of ways. I said, so why don't you start doing individual ATM? Right, because in that context, you can use your hands to guide, to interfere, to help somebody notice, and to be in the context of an awareness through movement lesson. I think that's entirely legitimate. You know, there's a, I think it's one of the FIs with Ken, which again, in the AYIA group, they've been watching the, here's a little plug, they've been watching the, FIs that Moshe gave in 1980 and 81. And if you are a member of your national guild or professional association, you're a member of the IFF and you can watch those for free. That was the plug. So anyways, they've been watching them together. And there's an FI that Moshe gives, I think it's Ken, where this guy's had a stroke. It's not his first lesson, but he's basically doing an ATM with them, getting him to go from lying on the table to sitting up. And it's a hands-on ATM. Or it's an FI with movement. I don't know, what do you call that? But I think that is, it's legitimate. And I think it is such an incredible way to engage our students because that really is coaching. It's helping them, you know, take the lesson with them. And yeah, so bully for you, don't stop. Yeah, but you have a doorbell around your house, Beth. I know. Anyways, we're officially out of time. I'm gonna stop talking. I'd be curious to hear your reflections. Hey, Dee Dee, to hear your reflections and your responses, ideas, whatever. I'll hang out for a few more minutes if you want. If you're ready to go. Please feel free to leave. I will take whichever are the better of these two. I'm sure I'm not going to say the same thing later today, so maybe I'll put both of them online and share them with you. But I'm glad. I'm curious to hear what you have to offer or say.
Can I say? I have something to say. I thought this was really fun and interesting. I didn't know it was going to be like this, which was fine. I didn't have to know, but it turned out to be a discussion of, you know, what we do in our experience in FI, and you know, for me, it could have been longer because I'm sure there are more. It's just so interesting to be able to have our colleagues and to be able to hear other people's experiences, just a conversation sort of, even though you were doing most of the talking, but that's okay. I really enjoyed this, Larry. It was nice. I'm not sure if this is what you wanted it to be, but it was lovely. Thank you.
I you know, I never know what I want it to be. You know, it's like with this course that I'm starting. I just put the link in there since this is supposed to be a commercial and I forgot to do it earlier. You know, I mean, I taught it a number of times. I feel like every time I teach something, I'm learning from what I have to teach and from how other people respond. And that's what makes it great to show up for work. You know, I mean, I always feel like I am learning at least as much as anyone else in the room is when I'm teaching. And I think when that stops, I'm going to give up. Because I'm not, like, if there's any truth to the social theory of learning, right, like role models and things like that, then people learn from what we do. And so if I want to inspire curiosity and engage people in learning, I shouldn't be modeling teaching. I should be modeling learning. Anybody else?
I have one more thing. I've taken this course, Returning to the Source, and I just want to recommend it. I might even do it again, although Larry told me I already did it. I don't know if that means I can't do it again, but it was excellent. I really thoroughly enjoyed it, so I would recommend it to anybody. Can I do it again?
Yeah, well, once you sign up for it, you will get the new versions of the lesson. This time, I'm teaching six of the lessons from the ATM book. And before, I would teach these little mini workshops where I would put three of them together in a half-day workshop. But this time, I decided to teach the whole thing as a series because series are important. You know, I mean, learning happens over time, and I wanted to talk about that in the course. So I'm going to teach them a new way so you and everyone else, because I think we got the technology hammered into shape, we'll get them the recordings as soon as the other participants get them. And we're using a new online school, which I think we've learned how to use now, which is really fucking awesome. And so you will get access to that. And I changed the structure of the classes because, well, like you said, I did most of the talking. So now I'm giving short talks, and then people are doing labs and breakout groups online where they can work with each other. So it's, you know, more kind of the flip curriculum, you know, not doing your homework at work, but coming to school and doing homework with the other students so you get to interact more. So yeah, it's a different class. I mean, so you'll get all the materials. If you want to do the class again, well, I ain't gonna stop you. You're lots of fun to have around. Hi, Catherine.
I'd like to ask a question. You've probably said all this already, but as I put in the chat message, I'm in a different time zone than I normally am. So it's like, missed the whole thing. In the course, one of the things that I've gotten really interested in is analyzing ATMs for where the constraints are and where differentiation is happening. And I was wondering if that's a part of your Returning to the Source course.
It is a part of it. It's a big part of it. Because you know, I think, like, the example that I gave about AY38 was, I think, you know, what part of the secret sauce of the Feldenkrais method, if you will, is this idea of adding constraints, that the way to freedom is through constraint. I'll tell you the basic idea, which is borrowed, so credit where credit is due. This idea comes from ecological psychology. This is J.J. Gibson and Eleanor Gibson's, who is like one of my heroes in science. And she's an amazing science, cognitive and developmental scientist. Anyway, ecological psychology is not about recycling. It's a model of experimental psychology that was a reaction to behaviorism in the 60s and comes from a very similar perspective, I think, as ours. It's systemic. Anyways, when ecological psychologists are talking about behavior, they make distinctions between three kinds of constraints. So there are environmental constraints. There are organismic constraints, and there are task constraints. And I think that relates to the three kinds of constraints that we deal with in our method. So I would say that there are, as environmental constraints, mostly we deal with the positional constraint, our relationship to gravity. So what's our base of support, what's holding us up, and what's free to move? The other part of the environment, you know, is like if there's a wall or a chair or a column in your way, that will impede your movement. But that's your relationship to the spatial and gravitational environment, right? And then there are configurational constraints. And by configurational constraints, I mean those, well, there's two categories. There's the ones you come with, which I would say are those that are built into the skeleton. The skeleton is the marionette. It determines what movements are possible. So if you have a cheap marionette, right, with just, you know, like all the legs and the arms are attached to one string, you know, that's different than if you have strings to every limb. You need more strings when you add elbows and more strings when you add the head and the chest. So the nature of the skeleton determines, those are the constraints that we come with. And constraint and variety, limitation and possibility are the flip sides. When it comes to an ATM lessons, a configuration is a shape that you put yourself in. And a configurational constraint is one in which, like, if I rest my right ear on my right upper arm, put my forearm on my top of my head, and my hand on the left side of my face or my temple or my ear, so that I've made a little package. Now, the shape, if I keep these relationships together, that shape adds constraints, because everything that's inside that shape, which means my wrist, my elbow, my shoulder joint, my sternoclavicular joint, the first rib, every vertebra above that, and my head are moving as a piece. So I have eliminated the movements in my, I'm speaking Australian today, my cervical spine, and I'm getting it in my thoracic spine. That's the second kind of constraint. And then, and I think this is the hardest thing for most people to wrap their head around at first, pretty much everything else you say is a constraint. And those are instructional constraints or task constraints. Because when I say reach forward, or when you say go slower, those are constraints, right? Those are limitations. I mean, not everything is a constraint, right? We say sometimes do it freely, but the part of the reason that's important is that a lesson's like an experiment. You want to control all the variables so you can change one thing and know what happens. So the art of the lesson, I mean, the teacher's job, first of all, is to create an environment where people can learn and it's safe. And part of making it safe is to make sure everyone's asking the same question in a safe way. And part of the way we do that is by creating this funnel where the question is compelling, where once the person asks the question, it's a simple question, they ask them one at a time, they can have a chance of answering it. So yeah, we'll go more into that, but there's the basic framework. So there's one of the classes, you can skip that one if you take the course.
Well, the interesting piece too is that the configurational constraint, even the one that you just gave as an example, that's what opens the doorway for differentiation too.
Absolutely. I mean, because what's inside the constraint is undifferentiated, mm-hmm. right? And so, and I think every lesson is a dance of differentiated and undifferentiated movements.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I make a table, right? What is moving and what's held? So we can move what's moving, we can hold what's moving, we can hold what's held, or we can move what's held. I think in the Feldenkrais method, we do everything except directly move what's held, right? So if somebody is holding somewhere, we don't try to make the move there. Because we are benevolently devious, because we approach the situation in a direct manner, by having someone hold what's moving, right, by closing a door that was open, then they find the movement somewhere else. That is totally consistent with, dynamic systems approaches to development, right, where they say instead of having a computer program in our head that determines step by step what's happening at moment to moment, that the nervous system works through what they call soft assembly, which means that we put together the best that we can from whatever's there. So if you think of my kitchen example, you don't have rice, you use pasta, right? The dish stays the same, but you rearrange it. So our nervous system is continually integrating, optimizing with the options that we have open. And that's what's beautiful about our method. We are not teaching. We're creating a situation where someone can discover something new. And that's because we fundamentally believe that people can learn when we give them a chance. And I love that you said constraints. There's a beautiful article that George Crutz wrote in the Feldenkrais Journal, maybe 15, 20 years ago, about a lesson being a wonderful waste of time. I just asked Stephanie Spink, his widow, if I could reproduce it. I'm writing a blog about it, but it'll be on the website soon. But he talks about constraints in there really beautifully too. So thanks. It's one of my favorite subjects. Thanks for bringing it up.
Well, you know, because, you know, I think a lot of people approach teaching ATM or FI like a recipe, especially in beginning. I know I did. You know, it's like, oh, got to memorize. And then what happens when I didn't memorize? You know, I didn't have it appear. And so then I had nothing. And through some of the mentors that I've had over the years, certain words have really surfaced as if you understand what the relationship of constraint and differentiation and integration and our nervous system as a system of inhibition, then it doesn't matter. There's no recipe. If you understand a move and movement pattern, if you understand a movement pattern and what's part of the pattern, then you can work with, okay, these are the parts of the pattern. If I constrain this part, then something else needs to move if a pattern's to play out, and so it goes. And that has been really, really helpful for me in both ATM and FI.
Look, I'm with you, right? The thing is that the elusive part of that is the pattern part.
Mm-hmm.
You know, speaking in a pattern language or thinking systemically. I'm working on this chapter for a book about the method that's a lot of people are writing chapters about. And I got asked to write the chapter about training Feldenkrais teachers, right? And one of the things is it's like, you know, a lot of people come and they want to add more tools to their toolbox. We have a different toolbox, right? And it is about being able to understand what the pattern is. Years ago, I had back when I lived in San Francisco, so this is the late 1980s. My office mate was David Moses, who was the editor of it was called Keep in Touch back then, our national newsletter. He's since left us. But Dave and I used to get together, and in our study group, our study buddy group, we would like pick a theme, and then we would bring all the lessons that we found about the theme. So this is like you know, the dark ages, like back, you know, we used to walk to school barefoot uphill in both directions in the snow kind of thing. But anyways, you know, I would come with the ATM book and maybe one recording that I had from Ruthie or Gabi. And David always would show up with a shoebox. And in that shoebox, he would have index cards and Xerox copies of notes from workshops he hadn't been to, right? Because he had this amazing network. And he would have recordings. You know, this was in the old days. They were on cassettes. And these were made before us. They were from the era before. So they were made in somebody's backpack or big hippie purse. And it was like, but we would have like 7 or 8 or sometimes 9 lessons about folding or about twisting. And we began, you know, we had some idea of what the pattern and the theme was, the red thread of the lesson was. And, but it was, you know, by exploring the different ways that Moshe approached it, it started to see that the lesson that we teach is part of a bigger terrain. Right. And so now when I teach a lesson, I think of it kind of as a lesson's like a park, and you guide someone, you create a path through that park. There's a lot of different ways through it. You know, what holds it together is what that pattern is. And, you know, to be like that great American poet E.E. Cummings, thing about a pattern is it isn't anywhere. It's an everywhere thing. Right. And that the teacher has to see the pattern. Mm-hmm. Right. The student doesn't necessarily have to do it, but it's like the student goes forward in time in the lesson and discovers. As a teacher, I have to know where we're going. So at very least, you know, I don't make things worse along the way. And I have some idea of how to guide the person. And that's the difference between those two perspectives.
I'm curious about this book that you mentioned. Is it a book on the Feldenkrais method with lots of chapters in different dimensions? And who's behind this?
Chris, who's not here, Chris is one of the people behind it. It is being published by an editor here in the United States. And there's two people who are editing it, both Feldenkrais teachers, and they've just asked a bunch of teachers really from around the world to do these different chapters. I don't know, maybe I wasn't supposed to say anything.
No, I'm very curious. With my background, my next question was going to be, do they need readers? As somebody who co-edited a book in my field in science education, I know we sent the book out to outside readers for feedback.
So, you know, that is wonderful of you to ask. And I need editors. So if you ever want to talk about that, I would love to. But do you know how to get in touch with Chris?
Chris Kresge? I can look her up on the website. That's not a problem.
Chris Kresge in D.C. You could write her an offer.
And I'd be glad to read and edit, help you with that, Larry. You're welcome. Yes.
Yeah, well, you know, writing and editing are two different things.
I know.
Thank you. Thank you kindly.
I know.
Well, my favorite part of the summer, I was teaching summer camp, which was about breathing. That was the second thing I was going to talk about. This summer, and I was writing like 3 blogs a week, and it was, you know, and it was cleaning my house and being an ATM monk, and I was having a great time. So I would love that support. Thank you.
I had to write my former career as an academic, so, and edit a lot.
Well, I started with a newspaper column in the local town newspaper when I was in high school. And I really, you know, I think, you know, part of my enticement to write is I think we have publicity. I certainly contribute to that. And we have the reports of the official organs of our professional relationships. But we have a dearth of journalism. And so I'm really interested in creating, you know, just reflecting on what we're doing and also reporting on what other people are doing around the world. That's why I've been doing interviews with people. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I want to, thanks for the reminder of Vygotsky. Vygotsky's mm-hmm. pretty amazing.
Well, social learning theory at its finest, the origins.
Well, you know, maybe we can have an online conversation about that sometime. Because if you know more about him, I would love for you to help introduce that to the community. I think that's pretty academic and obscure for most people, just but incredibly useful. And if you don't know who we're talking about, ask Auntie Google. She'll tell you. You can, if you're new to this group, you can, if you're in the chat, there's three little dots to the right of where the person's, you know, where it says everyone or someone's name. If you click on those three little dots, you can save the chat.
Mm-hmm. Larry, are you open to another question?
Yep, I'm not in trouble yet. Sure. I mean, if you guys are, I can hang out for a little while longer, and I'm having a great time. Ruth Vygotsky, it's right above your comment.
Sorry.
Go ahead, Judy.
Yeah, I had texted you. I would love to hear you speak about with Harriet Goslin's, where we really do work with, you know, the emotional and energetic. And I loved hearing you say, well, of course we include the whole person. If somebody comes to you, or, you know, let's just say, how would you talk about how the Feldenkrais method can help people with emotional healing? How would you make the connection for them? And are you okay with that question?
Oh, yeah. You can ask any question. I know I don't have to answer it, but no, that's a great question. Thanks.
I just love your perspective.
Thank you, kindly. Well, look, I'm having a little, my hesitation is that I don't have a one-size-fits-all kind of answer to that. So, you know, there was one point when I was living in San Francisco. At that time, there were a few people, Richard Bandler, one of the founders of NLP, a psychiatrist and a psychologist in San Francisco, that were referring people to me. And all of these people are people who had been sexually or physically tortured. And, you know, that was a point in time where I got supervision when I was working with them, because it was though I had trained in therapy before, it really took some work to be there. But, you know, that would, you know, in today's parlance, that would be like dealing with trauma. Though I think, you know, any physiological, emotional, physical, psychic shock, you know, we respond to that with trauma. And I think that's a physiological response, and it's part of what we're dealing with. So, you know, talking to somebody about that would be different than, like, last year or year before, I was working with this young kid who was autistic and was dealing with issues about his sexuality, right? I mean, these are such different subject matter. So how do I talk to the student and in one case to the parents about this?
Let me just say, in general, if we make it more general about, like, how does rolling around on the floor, how does floor work, you know, help somebody feel better emotionally? Is that more?
There's a few things. I mean, you know, if we go back to Moshe's quartet, feeling, acting, sensing, and thinking, the four components of the waking state, right, which is from Gurdjieff. But if we go back to that, then, you know, these things they're just different perspectives of us, right? So feeling, you know, the difference there between feeling and sensing is about perception. It's what we notice. And feeling is a comment on that. It's how we feel about what's happening, right? And these things develop together. They're intertwined. And I think that the most important thing that the work has to offer in terms of feelings is that as you do the work, you get a sense of, well, to quote a few presidential elections ago, you get the feeling of, yes, I can. You get the feeling that you are capable, that you're capable of learning and doing. And in terms of self-image and emotion and all those other things, I think that that's one of the great gifts of the method. So I think I think that's often where I would start to talk about it, you know? And I think once you, in the learning to learn part, once you learn about your capacity to learn and you begin to discover your innate abilities that we're meant to move easily and that we can learn, I think that's at the heart of what it means to develop our abilities is how we feel about ourselves, right? Every learner brings her or his entire history as a learner into the lesson or the class. And, you know, some people feel stupid, or we all feel stupid at some point, or frustrated, or however they feel about their bodies, or whatever, you know, whatever's going on with them. And I think we address that, like, what makes our work is that we start with action. And we work in that context. But that means, you know, the thinking and the sensing and the feeling part is part of that. Think about the teachers you loved, right? Where did they, how did they connect with you? How did they engage with you? It's on the person-to-person level. And, you know, the I and thou level. So I guess I would say I respond to it by contextualizing it in general and by coming back to what it means to work with action as a beginning place. Mm-hmm. Does that help?
And certainly helps. And I think maybe there's another layer. So like where, because people meet themselves on the floor, right? So, you know, one lesson can get them, you know, just feeling things they haven't felt in decades.
Absolutely.
And they get to speak to them, how to reassure them that, you know, this is an intelligent, you know, safe, efficient way to move forward. When it's so scary so quickly sometimes.
Well, you know, I think of Marie-France Rouillet, who's a Feldenkrais teacher and a physical therapist, an assistant trainer now, who for many years worked in psychiatric hospitals doing ATM with people there. Right. And that was a fairly progressive place just to, you know, because for in that setting, many people are afraid of the patients being experiencing their bodies or whatever. And you know, and she's not the only one. There are lots of people who have worked in that kind of setting with, you know, how do we introduce people to themselves physically in this way? But like, let's take a step back, okay? And I want to go back to the sensory motor loop, maybe to finish up too. You know, when we talk about habit, which we do talk about, right? A habit is what everyone else knows about you. It's what you keep doing, right? So, you know, most everybody can recognize their neighbor in the stormiest day, bundled up, you know, rain coming down, you can hardly see somebody. And maybe, you know, some of, you know, us and other people can say, oh yeah, that's Judy because her head's tilted that way and her leg's doing that. But, you know, that's the outside of a habit. That's the motor part. Almost nobody can tell you how Judy recognizes you. right? Because the inside of a habit is the perceptual and psychological phenomena of habituation, right? Which means that the things you do the most disappear. Or as I like to say in my sophisticated way, you don't smell the shit on the farm, right? And that's the nature of the nervous system. So the what you're talking about, I think, is it's a general phenomena. The aim of a lesson, right, if we're developing awareness, it's a clumsy word, so I apologize ahead of time, is to help the student dishabituate. Which, if you took an older metaphor, would be, you know, lifting the veil of illusion might work, right? That's the idea of habituation. And that's what I hope renders us all humble, right? Because we don't know the things we do the most, and we do them whether we need to do them or not. So the question is, not how do we change, you know, people say, just tell me what to do. And I want to say, but you don't know what the hell you're doing. So how do you know what to change? Right? So the beginning of the lesson, I mean, that's why we talk about awareness, is because we're unaware of the things we do the most. It's the nature of our nervous system. It is not a failure. It's a feature. It's a sign of successful learning that you don't have to think about it. Right, that it's become automated. But once it becomes automated, once the autopilot has control, how do you get control back? And that's the thing that we're great at, which is coordination, how to develop new ways of coordinating. And, you know, if we want to make the scope a little bigger, Judy, then it's not just our, you know, sensation and our movement, but it's our emotion. Look, your brain is not a computer that has feelings. It's a wet, messy thing that keeps trying to explain itself as if it is a computer. All right. I hope that.
Thank you. Thank you, Larry.
Where do you live, Judy?
I am based in the Florida Keys, but, you know, I just see where you're in Santa Cruz. Yeah, I do.
Yeah, no, I'm doing something. I'm doing some things down the street from Laguna Beach, in Laguna Beach, down the street from Harriet.
I'm sorry, go ahead. Now, when are you doing it? When are you doing it? Because I'm here now.
Oh, it's I did it last month. It's quarterly. It started a while ago. But here, I'll tell you a secret. Well, it's going to be a secret because I'm gonna pause So there you go, a little secret. Can't give everything away. So thank you for joining me. Thank you for spending time. I can't believe some of you are still here. I'm gonna get in trouble if I'm not ready when my friends get here in a few minutes. So anybody want the last word?
Thank you.
Thank you. All right.
Thanks and bye.
Bye-bye. Take care. If you have questions about the course, drop me a note or give me a call. There's my phone number. You can text me or call me. Really, that will reach me anywhere in the world. One phone number rules them all. So please feel free to get in touch. Have a great day. Bye.